Okay, well, it's a pleasure to be here. In fact, I grew up in Buffalo, so Toronto is sort of, you know, an old favorite of mine. I remember coming here many times on field trips as a little kid. So what I'm going to tell you about is about filtrations on instanton, not homology. So the place that this, one place that you, maybe to start telling the story is that is to recall a little bit about Kovanov homology, so, or, you know, most people, not being Eastern European, say Kovanov, and they don't follow his convention in his original paper and call it homology. However, I, being Eastern European and having read his original paper, will call it Kovanov cohomology instead of Kovanov homology. See. So this the Kovanov complex is something that comes up from a planar diagram of a knot, and it's it's a sum over bigraded pieces of you know, so if you have a diagram of a knot, then you can resolve it. So here's one resolution of the trefoil. That means we replace this guy by this thing or this thing. And whenever you have a resolution, then if you take care of all the crossings, then you get a picture of the unlink in the plane with some number of components. So if I fix, so this complex here is just actually turns out to be a sum of the sum over all of these resolutions of of a tensor product of two-dimensional vector spaces, one for each component of the resolution. Anyway, so it's a bigraded gadget, and the differential on Kovanov homology, on Kovanov cohomology. Oh well. If my brain were better, it would work better. It increases this grading, the cohomological grading I by one, and it preserves the what's called the quantum grading J in this description. So the cohomology of this chain complex is this bigraded group, the Kovanov cohomology. And a couple of years ago, actually, and with a little bit of a mistake, quite a bit longer ago, so Kornheimer and I, a couple of years ago, and Cullen and Steer, with some work that needed to be corrected a bit, defined an invariant of a knot, which is constructed from the Morse homology of the Chern-Simons function on a certain space of SO3 connections. So these are connections that actually have a singularity, a kind of log singularity, along a knot. I might say a little bit more about that later. And the upshot from this story is that you get actually a Z4 graded group. I think this is slightly incompatible with glasses. So this thing's a Z4 graded abelian group. And we also constructed a spectral sequence whose E2 term is the Kovanov homology, and I mean homology instead of cohomology here, Kovanov homology of the knot. And the E2 term is this Kovanov homology, and it converges to this I sharp of K that we defined. And we already knew that I sharp detected the unknot. So because of the, in fact, you could show that, sorry, this is, there's two very closely related groups, one which is related to this I sharp. There's another group, I natural, which is plays the role of reduced Kovanov homology. And we've proved that the reduced Kovanov homology detects the unknot using the fact that I natural is Z if and only if the group is unknot, which, so the fact that Kovanov homology detects the unknot follows from the spectral sequence. What I want to do in this talk is explain a refinement of the spectral sequence, which one thing you notice here is that this group is it's just a Z4 graded group, whereas Havanoff homology has a bigrading. So the thing I want to emphasize in this talk, which may be a slightly technical point, but there'll be a little bit of interesting, some quite pretty topology that happens later, which I'd like to try to sell you. So we want to see what happens to this to the bigrading as it passes through the spectral sequence, and what we see eventually is that there's a sort of bifiltration on this instanton homology, which is the ghost of the bigrading that was on the Kalmanoff homology. And in the process, there's also, in some sense, a little bit more three-dimensional version of the construction of Havanoff homology that seems to be coming up, though that bears some more thought. So slightly more precisely, this story that Peter and I thought about began with this observation that if you look at the space of representations of the fundamental group of a knot complement into SU2, but not all representations, only those representations where the meridian of the knot goes to the conjugacy class of this matrix inside SU2. So if you like, this is the SU2, of course, is the 3-sphere. So here's the identity matrix minus the identity matrix, north and south pole, and in the center there's this equatorial 2-sphere, which is the conjugacy classes of this matrix. So we want the meridian, so the fundamental group, by the way, is generated by meridians. We want the meridian, any meridian, to go to this conjugacy class. So, for example, if you look at the unknot, then the space of such representations is just exactly this equatorial 2-sphere. Or more generally, if you have an unlink of n components, then you just get n product of n copies of the 2-sphere, one for each component. And you notice this is, if I take homology, this reproduces the Havanoff homology of the unknot and the unlink. Not very exciting yet. Well, it gets a little more exciting if you look at the trefoil, where this representation space becomes a copy of the 2-sphere for irreducible representation, reducible representation, and there's another copy of RP3, which is SU2 mod plus or minus 1. And in this case, it's still true that the homology of this space reproduces the Havanoff homology. Now that's quite a bit more interesting because it even takes care of the fact that there's some 2 torsion and stuff, so that's a little bit subtle. Something a little bit subtle is going on. Just looking at the homology of the representation variety is far too naive. But what you should observe is that actually this representation variety you can think of as a space of flat connections on the 3-manifold, which is the knot complement with a certain kind of singularity along the knot. And flat connections are critical points of the Chern-Simons functional. So Chern-Simons functional, just for sake of completeness, is this guy integrated over y, where a is a one form on y with values in SU2, and its Chern-Simons of a, its gradient is the Hodge star of the curvature of the connection. So when the curvature is zero, we're at a critical point, and that's the relationship. So now, of course, it's no longer surprising. In fact, this was one of the first examples of Floor's work on Floor homologies to promote this sort of simple observation to the fact that you can actually do Morse homology for some interesting functionals on infinite dimensional spaces. So Floor's instanton homology came out of this. The version which allows for singularity along a knot is related to some work that Peter and I did in the early 90s on studying the instanton invariance, Donaldson invariance of 4 manifolds with certain invariance of a pair, four manifolds in the surface, which generalized the original Donaldson invariance. So, okay, yeah. So this work that I'm doing that we did is also motivated by some work earlier that related Hovanov homology to kind of a symplectic Hovanov homology defined by Seidel and Smith, and it's also closely related to some work of Katrin Wertheim and Chris Woodward, which defines a similar invariant in the quilted context. Okay, so here's a little bit more, I keep getting slightly more precise about instanton homology, but never quite get there. So here, there's one slightly technical point which you need to keep track of, which is that actually having reducible representations of the fundamental group, you know, so we're trying to do Morse homology on for the Chern-Simons function, which is a gauge invariant function on a space of connections. However, the gauge group often has fixed points, sometimes, or has not fixed points, but has points with non-trivial stabilizer. So you're trying to do kind of an equivariant Morse theory. That usually is a bad thing to try to do. But if you know that the critical points stay away from points with non-trivial isotropy, then things tend to go through. So there's a little trick that allows you to keep yourself in that context when dealing with this instanton case, which is to allow yourself to not just work with SU2 bundles, but look at SO3 bundles that have non-trivial W2. And the way we're going to keep track of that non-trivial W2 is that, well, imagine, so here's our three-manifold Y. Inside of it, there's some knot here, maybe a link. That's K. And we want to keep track of a certain two-dimensional cohomology class on the complement, and we're going to, on the complement of the knot, so we're going to keep track of that by looking at its Poincaré dual, which is a one manifold that has boundary, you know, maybe this three manifold has some non-trivial homology, so maybe, you know, maybe there's some closed loop here, but this dotted curve is supposed to represent the Poincaré dual of W2, okay? And that's important for the story. And as long as there's a surface in this four manifold, so that the moduli space of flat connections on that surface is a smooth manifold, then actually there'll be no reducible flat connections. So, for example, the only example that we'll actually use for this talk is if there's a torus. So the simplest interesting picture. Sorry, my knot was red here, and my W2 is this green arc that joins these two components. There's an obvious two torus that sits here, and this dotted arc hits it once. So if you think of the space of representations of the fundamental group of the two torus, Z plus Z, which have non-trivial W2, there's a unique one. It's irreducible. So if you see that inside your four manifold, your three manifold, you don't have to worry anymore about this technical point. So so that said, whenever you have a kind of decent principal bundle with this W2, you can define a chain complex, which is where the group is the set of the free abelian group generated by the critical points. There's some sign issue. Boundary map counts moduli spaces of instantons, solutions to the downward gradient flow equation, just as in symplectic floor homology or whatever. Boundary maps defined in this way, and the homology of this chain complex is an invariant independent of any perturbations, and it's denoted by this guy. Now, this guy's, it's just Z4 graded because the, you know, for the aficionados of floor homology, there's a spectral flow problem, and the space of connections modulo gauge has non-trivial fundamental group, and you have to think of there's spectral flow about around those generators. The spectral flow lives in 4Z, so there's only a well-defined grading modulo 4Z. Anyway, so it's C4 graded group. It has a nice property that's actually functorial under cobordisms of pairs. So if I have three manifold Y0 and Y1 with some knot sitting inside here and some surface, like so, as long as, again, there's some technical condition about the kind of principal SO3 bundle that we need to use, but as long as that technical condition is satisfied, which is automatically satisfied if it's satisfied at one end, then there's a map in floor homology which counts solutions to the instanton equation on this four manifold, the self-dual Young-Mills equation. Now, one important point to make. In general, so we picked in the story, we're looking at connections that have non-trivial holonomy around around some codimension 2 subset of the manifold that we're looking at. typically, it would matter which way we go. Right? But because we took this conjugacy class, which is the equatorial two-sphere, it doesn't matter which way we go. The holonomy, if I go around one way, might be I. The holonomy around the other way would be minus I, and those are conjugate. So, in fact, in this story, for this particular value, say alpha meant something that you don't know. But this choice alpha equals a half, which is just means that the conjugacy clad is this matrix, this in this equatorial two-sphere. That means that the surface that we use to induce the maps, it can be also non-orientable surface. Okay, so that's important for later. This is not actually important anyway. now, we want to get to actually invariance of knots in the three sphere, and so far the way I've set it up, we actually haven't allowed that because we need this non-trivial curve somewhere to make sure the bundle is admissible. And so what we can do, if we have a knot, then there's two ways we can naturally kind of promote it to a good enough situation. One is if I have my knot and I pick a point in a normal vector, then that's enough data to add a little meridional loop with this dotted curve omega here. So this picture is going from a knot in the three sphere for the pair S3K to the pair S3K natural, and omega is this dotted curve. another thing you can do is add a, so if you have your knot and then somewhere out there you have a plane and a vector in the plane, or a little disk and a vector in that disk, then that's enough data to stick in a Hopf link with a little dotted curve between them. So it's a rather trivial thing to do, but actually these constructions have nice meaning on the level of representation spaces. Maybe this construction is easier to understand. So if I looked at, remember, what I said at the earlier in the lecture was that the representations of the fundamental group into SU2 with this fixed, with this behavior along the meridian, that's the thing that's starting to look like Kovanoff homology, Kovanoff cohomology, sorry, Kovanoff cohomology. Actually, the critical point set of Chern-Simons is the space of flat connections modulo gauge. So that would be representation modulo conjugacy. And what actually this move, going from a not to the not K sharp, does is it changes the critical point set. So over here, the critical point set would be representations modulo conjugacy, whereas over here, the representations get rigidified, and this gives you just representations of the original knot group into SU2. So actually, this is a natural thing to do from that point of view. Now, so a little more precisely, the theorems that we proved were that, so now you sort of have some idea of what I natural is. That's the one that's coming from this guy. That's the thing that's related to the reduced Ivanov cohomology. And an older theorem that we proved is that K natural is Z if and only if this guy's if and only if K is the unknot. So this latter theorem actually comes from using the fact that these instanton theories, well, they by construction they work for three manifolds in general, and in fact you can carry them over not only to the context of three manifolds but to the context of sutured three manifolds. So that's a very powerful tool in three-dimensional topology, and it was used by Juhasz in the context of Haygard floor homology to kind of reprove and clarify a lot of theorems that had happened earlier, and we can carry over his work to prove this theorem. Anyway, so we get that reduced Kovanov homology detects the unknot. Now I want to explain a bit about where these spectral sequences and I'll start with some exact sequences, where they come from. So Ivanov homology has this sort of very basic property, almost its defining property, Ivanov homology, that if I have if I have two knots which are, you know, so if I have knots which are the same outside these balls, if I apply Ivanov to these guys, then Ivanov tells you there are maps. Sorry. And in fact, these maps fit into a long exact sequence. So it turns out that a similar thing is true for the instanton homology, and I want to explain a little bit about where that comes from. So, amazingly, I drew the same pictures. That's good. So I have these pictures. Here's actually a slightly different view of the same picture, just to show that there's a the fact that there are three guys here is quite natural. If you should think of these guys as you know, I take this tetrahedron, and there are three pairs of opposite sides on it, and you just think of that tetrahedron as sitting inside the two-sphere, and then you look at the three knots that you get by sticking in the three different pairs of opposite edges in the tetrahedron. Now, it's important to observe that So I want to introduce some notation here. So in Ivanov's story, you start off with this planar diagram, right? You look at this picture, and you have these crossings. I want to think of a slightly more general story in which actually the only thing that's important is that I have a three ball that's hitting the knot in a pair of arcs. Okay, so I'm going to call a three ball that's hitting the knot in a pair of arcs a crossing. And then and then if I have a crossing, then I can do this construction and get two other knots from it. Okay, another thing is that actually if I have this, if I orient the knot, then, you know, that is, I mean, this is one of those things where you have to have the Bureau of Standards three ball with a pair of arcs, right? So I have that one, and a crossing is a diffeomorphism of that pair into the three manifold, hitting my knot on this distinguished pair of arcs. So if I, since I have this Bureau of Standards guy, I can orient it. And if I orient the knot as well, then either that orient diffeomorphism can be orientation preserving on both components of the knot, or it can reverse orientation. And so a crossing, so once I have an orientation of K, each crossing has a sign, even in this context, which agrees with the sign in the usual setting. Now, these knots are cobordant via natural surfaces that live inside I times S3. And you know, it's a little bit easier to see it again from this tetrahedral picture. You know, here I have a cobordism that's joining these two edges to these two edges, you know, which is the graph of a function that's 1 on these two edges of the square, 0 on these two edges of the square, and you know, has sort of a singularity along the knot. That's okay for a cobordism. So this picture comparing over here is the cobordism from from K1 to K2. I mean, from K2 to K1. That's the way we're going. So like I said, the instanton homology is functorial, so there are natural maps on the instanton homology. And in fact, you can iterate these guys, and these guys, again, form an exact triangle along exact sequence as it did in Havanov. And let me try and explain a little bit of what goes into the proof of why there's an exact triangle. So what we want to do is think about what happens when we compose two of these cobordisms. Okay, so when we compose two of these cobordisms, so here's, this picture should really go in opposite order, but anyway. That should be 2-0. You know, this is one of those places where we're still paying for the fact that we don't use reverse Polish notation. You know, functions don't compose the way you write them down, really. So this is a little backwards, but the game is, if I compose two of these cobordisms, so that I glue, you know, the only place that anything interesting is happening is I'm just gluing these two bits of surface together. This edge is the one edge here, right? This one, and this one, this one. So when I glue them together, they fuse together. And then all of a sudden, these two, this arc here and this arc here, join together to form a closed loop in the composite cobordism. And that closed loop, if you think about it for a while, it's in this picture, it becomes a Mobius band in the three sphere, but I should really think of it as a four-dimensional picture. So there's some little twisted guy inside the S3 times I. And what happens then is that I get a cobordism from K0. This is going from K0, going from K0 to K1, and then K1 to K2. So this is a cobordism from 0 to 2. And what that cobordism looks like is the cobordism from 2 to 0, but viewed backwards, connected some RP2. That is, this you can see that this this little loop, if I take a little tubular neighborhood of it, the arc, which is sort of twice its boundary, actually bounds a disk inside the fourth sphere. So you get a little, you can cut along that guy, you get a little bit of surface, which turns out to be an RP2. Well, you need to practice a little bit to see that. But so there's this nice cobordism. So this composite cobordism has a different geometric realization. It's actually that a certain other surface cobordism connects some the pair S4 RP2. Okay. Now, let me draw the picture kind of schematically. So the instanton equation depends on choosing a metric on the four manifold. So what we've got is very roughly, after I've composed two of these guys together, I see somewhere inside here, I see an RP2 minus a disk. The map induced by the cobordism the map induced by the composite cobordism is what I get when I go from here to here and then from here to here. In this picture, I can imagine realizing this connected sum decomposition. So I have another picture where So for a metric where I'm completely stretched out along this guy, that's just a composite map. But now I imagine not stretching out completely and eventually taking this. There's actually a three sphere sitting here, which I'm going to pull out here. I get a one-parameter family of metrics. A one-parameter family of metrics is the kind of thing that in the yoga of this game that induces a chain map. A chain homotopy between two different maps. And what you can check is that actually it just induces a chain homotopy to zero. So this is the fact that the first step in proving that this thing is a short exact sequence, you prove the composite map is chain homotopic to zero, induces the zero map on homology, right? Now, with a little bit more cleverness, you can use these chain homotopies to further define chain maps from, say, the complex for the zero knot to the cone on the map. Here I have K2, K1, K0. They're maps. I wanted to do it this way. There's a map induced by this guy, and there's this chain complex here. So so there's a map. Map phi1 0 here. The chain homotopy that checks that this composite is zero is a map like this. H2 0. And you can check that actually these two maps together define a map from the mapping cone of this guy to here. And it turns out that, you can do the same thing again over here, and you get that the two natural maps that you write down are chain homotopy inverses. And so we prove then that this guy is is, say, quasi-isomorphic to the mapping cone, so that there's a long exact sequence. Okay, so that's the idea is, pretty simple. Just staring at what happens to these cobordisms, but you have to think for quite a while to see see why that's how to get something useful out of it. So I should say this argument's kind of I like to call it, this proof is kind of modeled on a proof that happens in a paper of Ashvath and Szabo that I'll mention later, and it uses what I like to call the distinguished triangle detection lemma. So, anyway. That was a sketch of how you get a short exact sequence. a long exact sequence, an exact triangle. Now, what happens, how do you get the spectral sequence? Well, what we want to do is actually take a collection of crossings and play the same game. So now we have a whole bunch of crossings. So again, there's a sort of generalized crossing. We have a whole bunch of maps of the three ball with a pair of arcs in. The images are supposed to be disjoint. And we get a collection of knots that obtained by taking any of the really. It's convenient in the story to keep to allow yourself to take the resolution where you don't do anything sometimes. Which is usually called two. That's the standard one for some reason. In the end, we can think of, in fact, getting a z to the number of crossings family of knots. The family is three periodic in each of the components, but it's, again, to get some signs going straight, it's convenient to think about it parameterized by z to the x. And then there are surfaces which give cobordisms from the knot kv. So kv just means that, so v is supposed to be, you're supposed to think of it as, it's a function from the components to z, and then I do one of the crossing guys in each of these balls labeled by that component. So if I only have one crossing involved, so that means that v differs from u in one place, then the surface is just like the one I drew before. It's just a product in all of these other guys, and there's just one thing going on. If I have several crossings in action, so here's a picture of what happens when I have three crossings in action, then there's an interesting parameter that arises, because I can think of the crossings that kind of happening at different times. Right. So, it's nice to think of these things, these cobordisms, really being Riemannian manifolds, and then there's some metric that's actually, you can measure the distance between the different points or something like that as a parameter. That's supposed to be, if v is bigger than u, then it's the, So this is a picture where in three of the balls, it differs only in one, each of those crossings differ only in one, by one click. If it differs by more than one click in some ball, if there's just one crossing, I'm also allowing myself to go from k minus 5 to k 7, and then I would allow a whole bunch of crossings to happen, just concatenating the obvious one-handle cobordisms. So each of these guys comes with a family of metrics. That family of metrics has an obvious action of translations on it, which is the effective parameter in there. So if we specialize to the most important case that looks like the Hovanov cube, where u and v are in 0, 1 to the x, then we get the family of metrics, action of translations, and we're going to let this g check vu denote the quotient of this family of metrics by translation. So we can define a map the map's going to be defined by its action on components. So see, this is a chain complex for the knot kv. This is a chain complex for knot ku. And the map is given by counting solutions to the instanton equation where the metric is varying. So the metric's varying in this family g check of vu. So we count solutions in zero-dimensional moduli spaces of these things, just like the differential was defined. So this is the definition of a map when V is bigger than U. When V equals U, it's just the ordinary differential, and when V is less than U, it's just zero. So we get a kind of Kovanov cube-like thing of resolutions, Kovanov-like cube of resolutions. So we take the direct sum over U in here, and the maps are given by the matrix entries are given by this kind of guy. And it turns out that you can generalize the proof that the original Kovanov chain complex is a chain complex, that the square of this guy is zero, to check that actually the square of this F is zero. So this is really a chain complex. This is a strict generalization of the mapping cone when there's one crossing. So if you think about this definition where there's just one crossing, this is just the mapping cone that I was looking at before. This is generalize it. This is a chain complex. And it turns out that it's chain homotopy equivalent to the original instanton chain complex. So you get you get this cube of resolutions. Now this a priori has nothing to do with Kovanov homology. It's just actually a kind of a way of computing the instanton homology. So whenever I have these set of generalized crossings, there's a spectral sequence that computes the homology from the homology of all the different resolutions. Okay, which may or may not be useful, but it becomes a little more evidently useful if, for example, you have what we call a pseudo-diagram. So a pseudo-diagram is the case where for U in 0, 1 to the X, all of those guys are unlinks. So that's what happens when you have a planar diagram. That's what's sort of special about a planar diagram. In a planar diagram, if I look at all of these balls, and I look at the 0, 1 resolutions, look at the total resolution where all of these are replaced by 0 or 1, then all of those guys are unlinks, obviously, because they're just planar curves that don't meet. So they're a bunch of unlinks. But there's no reason, if, for example, I forgot this guy, I just looked at these two crossings, right? Then I no longer, these two crossings, I can look at the resolutions of, where I only resolve these two balls. And if you think about it for a minute, well, what you've got is a picture where you have a diagram which is planar except for one crossing. Well, a diagram like that is always a diagram of unlinks. So this is a picture where, in fact, if I only use these two balls, it's a pseudo-diagram, but not a diagram. I need to include this guy. Or you can check more generally if I had a picture, if I have a diagram where somewhere in the diagram there's an arc that goes over a whole bunch of guys. If I ignore all of these guys, all of these crossings, and include all of the other ones, then it's still a pseudo-diagram. Because I'll get a planar diagram, but now where there's one arc that's always going over everything, and nothing else is going on. So that one you have to be able to move that away from the rest of the picture. Anyway, so, okay. Now, in the case of a pseudo-diagram, that should be I sharp, actually. No, not I natural. I natural is the reduced guy. I sharp is the non-reduced guy. Each of these guys are unlinks. For the unlink, the critical set is a product of copies of S2s. If I perturb, then I'm just going to get 2 to the B0, 2 to the number of components of the not critical points, and I have a chain complex. These guys are in even degrees. There's no differential. So, in fact, this group, the I sharp for an unlink, is just z2 to the number of components of the knot as a group. So, and with a little bit more work, if you think of the filtration by V, the E1 page of the spectral sequence can be determined with the differential, so you have something that you can actually at least compute the E1 page of just from pictures. Now, what's special about a planar diagram is that, so two things are special. From this point of view, the surfaces SVU for planar diagram are always orientable. They're always pairs of pans. If I have, if I do this move, there's, in this picture, we're doing, doing this move. So there's two possibilities on how these things connect up, but it's always always a pair of pans. But if this is not a planar picture, then there's no reason that we can't have we can't have this thing going on. And in this situation, we still added just a one handle, but now we've gone from one component to one component. So this is a twice punctured RP2 sitting inside S3 cross I. This is what doesn't happen if it's planar. Okay? So when it's planar, you get pairs of pants, and it's easy to figure out what the pairs of pants do on this instanton homology. Just reproduces the Khovanov TQFT. So that's sort of where the spectral sequence comes from. And again, this is motivated, as I mentioned in this, our construction here is motivated by this paper of Ashbath and Szabo, where they related the Haygarth 4 homology of a double branch cover of a link to the, at least mod 2, to the reduced Khovanov homology of the knot, and in particular that their proof of the existence of the spectral sequence is somehow conceptually really important and came through in this story. And there's also a kind of similar looking story to this one for the Cyber-Glitten equations that's just been established by Jonathan Bloom. Now, I want to explain how, if you pay attention to the topology a little bit more, then you can actually refine what I said the instanton group is only mod 4 graded, but we'd like to see if we can extract from the spectral sequence a filtration on the instanton homology. Of course, once you have a spectral sequence, once you have these cubical spectral sequences, then there is a filtration, but there's no reason that if I take two different instances, say two different diagrams of the knot, there's no reason a priori why that spectral sequence should give rise to the same filtration. Okay, so what I want to try and explain is some of the ideas that go into checking that, in fact, you get the same filtration. And it's important, in order to explain how this goes, it's important to understand the dimension formula for the moduli spaces that go into defining the maps induced by cobordisms. In particular, for that story, we need to recall a little bit of quite cute four-manifold topology, which is if you have a surface inside an oriented four-manifold, then it has a self-intersection number in Z, whether or not the surface is orientable. Okay? So of course, since the self-intersection number is symmetric, obviously it doesn't depend on an orientation. That's not so interesting. What's more interesting is that even if it's non-orientable, it has a self-intersection number. And that self-intersection number can be non-zero even if the surface is null homologous. Okay? And so I want to explain that with an example. Since basic example is the two interesting RP2s in S4. and they have self-intersection number plus and minus 2. Now, where do they come from? We can think of them as arising from the fact that CP2 modulo the real involution is S4, so you have to believe that somehow. If you're a Kirby calculus aficionado, then you will easily check that the double branch cover of S4 over a certain RP2 is CP2, but this is actually an observation of Kuiper's in the 60s, and you can write it down concretely many different ways. But anyway, it's a fact. From this equality, there's two evident RP2s, one of which is the fixed point set of conjugation. There's an RP2, the real RP2 in CP2. It pushes down to an RP2 inside S4, but in pushing down, the normal bundle gets doubled, right? So it has the self-intersection number of this fixed point guy is minus 2, which is twice, sorry, that's 2 times minus the Euler characteristic of RP2. That RP2 inside CP2 is Lagrangian, so its normal bundle is isomorphic to its cotangent bundle, right? So that's why you know it's minus the Euler characteristic if you keep your signs straight, right? There's another obvious RP2, which is to take, a real conic that should be without real points, no real points, right? Like this guy, then conjugation acts freely on that guy. It obviously acts in an orientation reversing manner, so its quotient is an RP2, and now that's an RP2 with self-intersection number half as big as the square of a conic, which is 4. So these are an RP2 with self-intersection plus 2, an RP2 with self-intersection minus 2. And in fact, you can, it's a theorem, so it, I mean, it's easy to check that, say, if you have a surface in S4, then its self-intersection number is congruent to twice its Euler characteristic mod 4. And more generally, it's a theorem of Massey that actually this self-intersection number in absolute value is less than twice its Euler characteristic. So now the dimension of this, the moduli space that's used in defining this differential, let me give you a picture to have in mind here. So, so over at this end, I have some number of product of S2s. Over at this end, I have some other number of two spheres as the critical point set of Chern-Simons, and then I have this family of metrics that's inducing a map between the four homologies. If I perturb the Chern-Simons function so that it becomes a Morse function on this product of two spheres, it's natural to think of a sort of bottom critical point and a top critical point. Right? There's two components here, and I want to think of what happens to the. At this end, I want to think of what the things that go to the bottom critical point. You know, maybe again, there's two components, and I want to look at the moduli space that's leaving the top critical point and ending at the bottom critical point. Why I'm doing that is because that's the easiest one whose dimension we can compute, because that has the same dimension as if I tacked on disks to both ends and looked at a moduli space inside the four sphere of connections. These are essentially the ones that extend over that over what happens when I include those disks. Anyway. just to see how some of these things fit together. So the dimension formula, so this part is actually the dimension formula for the moduli space without the family of metrics. This kappa is the churn number of the thing that we're looking at, the 1 over 8 pi squared, the integral of the churn form. So that's one bit of the formula. There's this Euler characteristic of the, this S bar is that surface that I just mentioned, the one that you get by capping off the disks in the force sphere. So there's the Euler characteristic of S bar and self-intersection number of S bar, half the self-intersection number of S bar. So that's what the dimension formula looks like after you apply the index theorem, and then you have to add in the dimension of this guy. Now, the dimension of this guy is interesting. So actually, you notice that these cobordisms are built up from two things. It's either built up from taking a pair of pants and some products, or an RP2 minus two disks. Now both of these are the characteristic minus one surfaces. So actually what this Euler characteristic is encoding is the number of vertices on which these two guys differ. So that, so this thing has a meaning. It's the Euler characteristic of this surface. But this is the unclosed-up surface. This is the closed-up surface. So what's going to be important in a second is to figure out what this thing is mod 2. Now, what you can check is that this thing is congruent to this thing mod 2, where we use the fact, we use this previous equality that twice the Euler, that the self-intersection number is twice the Euler characteristic mod 4, so that half the self-intersection number is the Euler characteristic mod 2. So this thing is half the self-intersection number mod 2. These things cancel out. This thing is actually, this kappa turns out to be 1/16 the self-intersection number mod a half. So again, it's half the self-intersection number mod 2. So altogether, these two guys, these three guys just give me one of these guys in the end, mod 2, and you have this formula. That'll be important in a second. So here's the definition of S bar. So S bar is this closure in the force sphere when these guys are unlinked, capping off each of the unlinked components. And what I need to do here is explain, in Hovanov homology, the homological grading really is not just we have this cube, and I can cut the cube into great diagonals, and that's your first guess as to what the homological grading is. But if you want the thing to be invariant under Reiter-Meister moves, you have to shift it by something. That just depends on the knot that you started with. And there's a similar story that you have to tell here, which is a little bit more interesting, and it involves this function sigma of VU, function on pairs of points, which is sigma is the self-intersection number of this closed-up surface if V is bigger than U, and I extend it to all pairs by requiring this kind of additivity property. So I require that sigma of VU is minus sigma UV, which is definitely not the self-intersection number. That doesn't change if I change the surface, right? But that's this function. The other thing to notice is that an orientation of K gives us a preferred smoothing. Namely, there's an orientation of K, there's a unique smoothing where each component has the right orientation. So there's a distinguished vertex in this cube, O, the oriented one. And then you need to have this grading shift for pseudo-diagrams in order to have things work out. And the grading shift, so that in Hovanov homology, when you have a planar diagram, the grading shift doesn't involve this bit. But for pseudo-diagrams, you need this bit, which is keeping track of some the cell intersection number data. And now, with this choice, you can check that this differential increases the filtration level by at least one, and you need to put together two facts from this. One is that the sort of the order of this map in H as it maps U to V is from this formula, it's the difference of the V's minus this sigma. Sigma is, so V has to be bigger than U, so this is a positive number. This guy, if I cut this cobordism up into each of its individual pieces, each individual piece where they differs at plus or minus 2. So this is a sum of plus or minus 1s, 1 for each component where it differs, so this thing is positive, right? On the other hand, the dimension formula tells you, if you look at this thing, actually those maps all have odd degree. So it has to have positive degree and has to be odd, so the degree has to be actually at least, at least 1. So this is sort of the generalization of the fact that with this shifted grading, it still behaves like a differential. Right? Now, I, since I'm out of time, I won't go into this too much, but just to say that once you get that straight, you can nicely kind of figure out what happens when you drop and add crossings as long as you remain in the context of pseudo-diagrams. And you can check that if you have two pseudo-diagrams which differ by dropping and adding adding a crossing, generalized crossing, then they induce the same filtration. that's the proof, never mind. Once you know that, then you can actually kind of reprove the Reitemeister invariance much more simply. Because now we get to, so I want to do this Reitemeister 3 move and check that I get the same isomorphic filtrations on this spectral sequence. And the proof now becomes I can just drop these two crossings. If I do an isotopy, that's filtration, that induces a filtration preserving map, so I isotope this guy here, and now I add these two crossings. And I haven't done anything horrible, you know? So anyway, there's a lot of other fun stuff that you can do, but that's it.